pray, read the scriptures, sacred poetry, or meditation from an inspirational book. Think about the day ahead and how it might unfold more smoothly. Invoke divine order, asking Spirit to take charge of your life today and every day. Visualize yourself at the end of a happy, stress-free, productive day, relaxing and enjoying the well-deserved leisure of the evening. Stroll into the backyard garden, onto a balcony. Sit on the front porch or front stoop with a cup of coffee and wait for the sun to rise. Observe how gently but surely the natural world renews itself daily. You may not believe this, but Mother Time does not rush. 7 o'clock does not tell 6 o'clock. Get a move on. There are places to go, people to see, faxes to send. If you have children, have to commute 90 minutes to work, or need to reach European clients on the telephone, as do 3 very good friends of mine, what I am suggesting probably seems impossible. Recommended by a woman who obviously hasn't a clue as to how you really live. Bookending your day by nurturing your spirit means rousing your body earlier when you're so exhausted from yesterday that you can barely crawl out of bed, or spending an extra moment with yourself at night when you're ready to fall asleep like a stone. Here's what I do many mornings and evenings. A half hour before I have to rise, and just before I go to sleep, I lie snuggled in bed and listen in the dark to Gregorian chants, the sublime ancient Latin invocations sung by Benedictine monks for the last 1500 years. It's a pity I don't understand every word the monks are singing, but it doesn't really matter. All I know is that the soft, rhythmic chants reassure and soothe me on a very deep level. Sometimes I pray with the monks. Other times I like to imagine they are praying for me. It's a gentle centering and a comforting reminder that another, truer reality exists, something that I'm apt to forget in the middle of the day, as you probably are too. Seek order within, so that divine order may be manifest outwardly in your daily round.
House ordering is my prayer, and when I have finished, my prayer is answered, and bending, stooping, scrubbing purifies my body as prayer doesn't. Jessamine West.
You clean a cluttered closet, slowly sorting through clothing, considering what is to be saved, stored, or shared with others. She is there. You gather together the fruits of the earth on the altar of your kitchen counter, baking not a blackberry pie, but a benediction, invoking an unspoken blessing for those who will partake of your love offering. She is there. You ready the guest room to welcome friends to your home, dressing the bed with your best linens, laying fluffy towels on the chair, arranging a bouquet of flowers next to the reading lamp, along with a few of your favorite books. She is there. You polish the silver, fold the laundry, iron the tablecloth, wash the dishes, replace the candles. She is there. Hestia, the venerable domestic spirit. We may not have known her name, but we have felt her move through us when we experience pleasure in our daily round. 3,000 years ago in ancient Greece, Hestia was the goddess of the hearth, guardian of family life, and the temple. It was to Hestia that women turned for protection and inspiration, so that they might, as an act of worship, transform their dwelling places into homes of beauty and comfort. Hestia was one of the 12 Olympians in classical Greek mythology, but she is the least known of all of the deities, and there are no legends about her, even though Zeus bestowed on her the privilege of sitting in the center of their celestial home so that she might receive the best offerings from mortals. While the other gods and goddesses were personified in sculpture and paintings, Hestia was not rendered in human form. Instead, her spiritual presence was honored as an eternal flame burning on a round hearth. Jungian analyst and author Jean Shinola Bolen tells us in her book, Goddesses in Every Woman, that Hestia's sacred fire provided illumination, warmth, and the heat necessary for food. Despite her anonymity through the ages, the goddess Hestia's presence in the house and temple was central to everyday life in ancient Greece. Today, as in ancient times, reflecting on Hestia focuses attention inward to the spiritual center of a woman's personality, according to Dr. Bolan, enabling us to tap into an inner harmony as we go about our daily round. Hestia is not frazzled, hanging on by a thread. Instead, Dr. Bolan writes, Hestia is grounded in the midst of outer chaos, disorder, or ordinary everyday bustle. Everything that needs to get done in the home is accomplished with ease and grace. By knowingly seeking encounters with Hestia in our daily life, by letting her quiet, calm, orderly presence influence our behavior, we can come to the awakening that there is sacred mystery in the mundane. And just how do we do this? Sometimes I'll invoke Hestia's help as I work around my home. Or I'll ask myself, is this how Hestia would approach this task? Of course, if I have to ask that question, I know it's not. But the question brings my awareness back to the contemplative nature of home caring. Most of all, Hestia gently reminds me, as Dr. Bolan points out, tending to household details is a centering activity equivalent to meditation, if we want to make it so. If you feel you have no time to sit down to meditate, that you have a valid excuse for not seeking communion with spirit because the floor has to be swept, realize that if you approach your tasks with reverence, it won't only be your home that will be transformed. The goddess knows what it takes to run a household, and she has deemed it holy. So should you.
Harmony.
The previous simple abundance principles, gratitude, simplicity, and order, prepare us easily for the pursuit of personal happiness, as the sweet strains of the fourth principle, harmony, start to make themselves heard in our ears. Do you remember what you were doing the weekend of August 16th and 17th in 1987? If you do, perhaps you were among the more than 144,000 people who journeyed to power points around the world, such as Egypt's Great Pyramids, Peru's Machu Picchu, Japan's Mount Fuji, the temples of Delphi in Greece, Mount Shasta, California, Sedona, Arizona, the Black Hills of South Dakota, and New York's Central Park, to hold hands, hum, and resonate in harmony in the New Age global event known as the Harmonic Convergence. What made this weekend so significant was a rare astronomical occurrence known as a grand trine, when all nine planets were in their astrological fire signs and positioned exactly 123 degrees apart from each other. It had been 23,412 years since the last one. Now add an esoteric interpretation of ancient Mayan and Aztec calendars, and a Hopi legend about a gathering of enlightened teachers meant to awaken humanity, and it's not surprising that thousands of New Agers decided that circumstances were as perfect as they'd ever be to direct the Earth through meditation towards a peaceful spiritual awakening instead of a cataclysmic one in the next millennium. It seems to have worked. Each week, another visionary book is published encouraging spiritual evolution as the road less traveled becomes the inspirational superhighway. But there are so many voices offering clues, glimmers, and insights on how to achieve harmony through the divine grand trine of mind, body, and spirit. How do you discern your own truth? And there are so many spiritual paths. Which one should you follow? In undertaking a spiritual life, what matters is simple. American Buddhist master and teacher Jack Kornfield reassures us in his wonderful book, A Path with Heart, a guide through the perils and promises of spiritual life. Jack tells us we must make certain that our path is connected with our heart. When we ask, "Am I following a path with heart?" we discover that no one can define for us exactly what our path should be. Instead, we must allow the mystery and beauty of this question to resonate within our being. Then, somewhere within us, an answer will come, and understanding will arise. If we are still and listen deeply, even for a moment, we will know if we are following a path with heart. For me, bearing witness to my authentic self is the most joyous and fulfilling spiritual path I've ever followed. It is truly a path with heart. It began when I acknowledged that creativity is holy. Perhaps this week you might like to convene a personal harmonic convergence through rediscovering, recovering, and celebrating your creativity, the sacred conduit to access your authentic self. It's never too late to reclaim your individual gifts, resuscitate a dream, create an authentic life. Consider this. What if original sin is denying instead of celebrating your originality? Each of us possesses an exquisite, extraordinary gift, the opportunity to give expression to divinity on earth through our everyday lives. When we choose to honor this priceless gift, we participate in the recreation of the world. When we follow our authentic path with love, embracing our creative impulses, we live truth, even if what we think we're doing is just planting a flower bed, cooking a meal, nurturing a child, editing a book, producing a television show, sewing a curtain, writing a brief, painting a picture, teaching a craft, composing a song, or closing a deal. As the Vietnamese Buddhist monk, poet, and writer Thich Nhat Hanh reminds us, our own life is the instrument with which we experiment with truth. Martin Buber, the great Jewish philosopher, told a story about a Hasidic enlightened master named Rabbi Zusa, who often pondered whether he was living an authentic life. If they ask me in the next world, why were you not Moses? I will know the answer. But if they ask me, why were you not Zusa? I will have nothing to say. How well we'll hold up our end of this revealing conversation is what begins to interest us now as the fourth simple abundance principle, harmony, starts to stir within our souls. Discerning our personal gifts is essential if we are to experience harmony in our lives. Because our gifts carry us out into the world and make us participate in life, the uncovering of them is one of the most important tasks confronting any one of us. Elizabeth O'Connor writes in The Eighth Day of Creation, Gifts and Creativity. When we talk about being true to ourselves, being the persons we are intended to be, we are talking about gifts. We cannot, she tells us, be ourselves unless we are true to our gifts. However, it's difficult to be true to our gifts if we don't know what they are. And while masters, mystics, saints, sages, poets, and philosophers have borne witness to the authentic path down through the ages, many of us have tuned out. Why? I believe it's because the lesson of authenticity is often prefaced with the four most terrifying words known to the human race: the will of God. Divine will is frequently associated with suffering, so it's no wonder many of us choose, consciously or not, to slip into a spiritual abyss of unknowing. Trust God? Been there, done that. Thanks, but no. Prefer to go it alone. But even in the black hole of doubt, we want to believe that a force greater than our own power or understanding is with us. And it is. The force is with your authentic self. As Obi-Wan Kenobi tells Luke Skywalker in Star Wars, the force is an energy field created by all living things. It surrounds us. It penetrates us. It binds galaxies together. The force binds your dreams and desires with your personal gifts so that they can find outward expression in the world. Follow your feelings, trust your feelings, the Jedi Knight urges us all, because it is within the force that we live and move and have our being. The force is love. Love wants, wishes, and wills nothing less than your unconditional happiness, harmony, and wholeness. Today, commit to discovering, acknowledging, appreciating, owning, and honoring your personal gifts. And may the Force be with you.
After all, it is those who have a deep and real inner life who are best able to deal with the irritating details of outer life. Evelyn Underhill.
It is a subtle irony, but one not lost on my authentic self, that while writing a book of meditations, a work that you might imagine springs from the author's deep spiritual reserve of calm, I seemed to be in perpetual motion. This was either a cosmic joke or a cosmic lesson, which I could choose to learn the easy way or the hard way. It's not enough to write about simple abundance. I have to live it daily, or I might as well have written science fiction. I desperately need to restore harmony in my life, to find balance again between the inner and the outer, the visible and the invisible. Today, the strings on this instrument are very taut. I've got to loosen them so that they don't snap. Maybe you feel the same way. Maybe the pitch of pressure is too high, the tone in your voice too sharp, the decibels of the demands on you deafening. We need to explore the fourth simple abundance principle, harmony, most deeply when life is out of tune. I recently read a lovely book, A Spiritual Journey, written by a gifted woman writer who actually went to a monastery in order to concentrate, create with clarity, and complete her book on time. You can imagine what part of her journey made the strongest impression. Since I obviously cannot follow her example without abandoning husband, child, and animals, all of whom are waiting at this very moment to be fed, I'll stop and head into the kitchen. I might not be able to say Mass or meditate today, but I can make a meal. The home is a sacred place where you can communicate with the four elements of the universe, earth, water, air, and fire, says writer and kitchen mystic Laura Esquivel, author of the luminous novel Like Water for Chocolate. You mix it with your love and emotions to create magic. Through cooking, you raise your spiritual level and balance yourself in a world that is materialistic. In a world that is frequently out of kilter, the kitchen is as mystical as a monastery. Slice red and yellow bell peppers, tiny eggplant, and zucchini into strips. Chop red onions, fresh basil, oregano, and Italian plum tomatoes. Sauté slowly in good olive oil and minced garlic until the vegetables are soft. Take a sip of wine. Add penne pasta to boiling water for 6 minutes. Grate fresh Parmigiano Reggiano cheese. Warm store-bought rosemary and ricotta focaccia in the oven. Toss the pasta and vegetables together. Sprinkle with cheese. Call everyone to the table. Stop to give thanks. Offer a toast and a thanksgiving for good health, love, companionship, delicious food, and a moment of contentment. A day fully lived, simply abundant. An Irish proverb tells us, better one good thing that is, rather than two good things that were, or three good things that might never come to pass. Today there was no need to glance wistfully at the past or project anxiously into the future because the present was fully lived and simply abundant. Today was rich with one good thing after another until it literally overflowed with pleasure. However, not too long ago, an 8 a.m. phone call announcing a major change in plans sent my day careening out of control. I hung up the telephone, my heartbeat accelerating. In one stroke, my carefully arranged coping strategy was out the window, and my host of commitments had been made almost unmeetable. This was too much, I thought, as I paced back and forth, muttering and moaning under my breath. I had three choices before me, but only one real-life solution. Scream with rage at the top of my lungs, put my head in the toilet, or take a deep breath and redeem the day with Plan B. Since I have an understanding in my home not to do anything that might alarm children or animals, screaming was out. The toilet bowl was out as well. Look, if you're really going to drown yourself, you can't do it in a bucket of water. So I poured a cup of tea and recalled the Hasidic prayer. I know the Lord will help, but help me, Lord, until you help. The reality was that the day would be as hard as I made it, or as pleasant. There was nothing I could do about my circumstances but accept them. It's always my choice, I reminded myself. Not necessarily to like whatever life throws at me, but to try to catch the ball. After all, success in life is not how well we execute Plan A. It's how smoothly we cope with Plan B. And for most of us, that's 99% of the time. I considered Plan B. Redeem the day with simple pleasures, some good things to look forward to. At first, learning to smoothly shift gears to Plan B takes some attitude adjustment. But like driving a car, it becomes an automatic reflex with practice. First, I took my tea out into the garden to calm down. I pulled a few weeds, picked some flowers. After arranging them, I looked at cookbooks. Should I prepare something new for dinner tonight, or a comforting favorite? I decided to stop off at the farmer's stand for fresh produce on my way home and see what appealed to me. Why not pick up a good movie as a treat after supper? The peaches on my table were perfectly ripe, so I decided to make dumplings when I got home. In the meantime, I had an hour to work uninterrupted before I had to leave the house, and decided to make the most of it. Better a golden hour that is, than two that were, or three that obviously will not come to pass today. The day stretched before me, not as I had hoped, but not, thank heaven, beyond redemption.
The table is a meeting place, a gathering ground, the source of sustenance and nourishment, festivity, safety, and satisfaction. Lori Colwyn.
Whether we're single, married, with or without children, we all have to eat dinner. The evening meal should be the highlight of the day. If the day has been peaceful, pleasurable, and profitable, it's time to celebrate. If the day has been difficult and discouraging, it's time for comfort and consolation, blessings by themselves, and reason to celebrate. Either way, the celebrating table bids. Just as there are different food categories, there are different types of dining: make-do, carry-out, homestyle, and feasts. All of us make-do sometimes, but as a lifestyle choice, a crust of French bread and a heel of salami can quickly lead to psychic starvation and dietary deprivation. Carry-out meals can cut corners miraculously, but are extremely expensive, and a steady diet of restaurant food will make you feel as if you've been on the road too long. Homestyle is what I call Monday to Friday suppers, which with planning can be easy, fast, and delicious. Weekends call for your favorite meal one night, and a culinary feast the next. We need time to diffuse, to contemplate. Just as in sleep our brains relax and give us dreams, so at some time in the day we need to disconnect, reconnect, and look around us, the wonderful writer Lori Colwyn reminds us. We must turn off the television and the telephone, hunker down in front of our hearths, and leave our briefcases at the office, if only for one night. We must march into the kitchen en famille or with a friend and find some easy, heartwarming things to make from scratch. And even if it is but once a week, we must gather at the table and eat a meal together. We know that without food we would die. Without fellowship, life is not worth living. So come, the celebrating table bids.
Setting a table is so much more than just laying down knives and forks. It is creating a setting for food and conversation, setting a mood and an aura that lingers long after what was served and who said what was forgotten. Perry Wolfman.
When preparing a meal, the last thing many of us think about, except when we're expecting company, is our table setting. For guests, we'll bring out the good china, stemware, and linens. But for ourselves, the everyday, no matter what shape it's in, will have to do. Yes, it will be fine if that's all you have. But if you continually choose the chipped over the beautiful china behind the glass doors when you don't have to, then making do is not enough. The rituals of nourishment cry out for the communion cups, the special plates on which to break bread, the candle flame, the circle drawn in the dirt. Ritual protects and heals. Ritual symbolizes to all who come to your table seeking rest and renewal that they are enclosed within a sacred space. You may think you're only laying a place at the supper table, but when you trust and follow your creative impulses to bring forth something beautiful, you experience the sacred in the ordinary. Moses looked for God in the burning bush. We need look no further than our own tables, the tables that the Hebrew psalmist tells us have already been prepared so that our cups might runneth over. When I think back to our family meals, it isn't the taste or smell of the food that I recall as much as the way the scene looked, reminisces Perry Wolfman, co-author with her husband Charles Gold of The Perfect Setting and the owner of the New York tableware store Wolfman Gold and Good. The ambiance of the table, the patina of the wood, the candlelight, the colors, the sense of harmony and order. Today our style of entertaining has become more casual than the starched linen and polished silver of our grandmothers. Yet the sense of harmony that can be conjured up with an inviting table setting has not changed, nor has the need. If anything, we hunger for harmony more than we do for sustenance. But we don't need to feast from damask every day. A beautiful pine table set with lovely French linen tea towels as placemats, and with lap-sized napkins, pottery plates, oversized water goblets, votive candles, and a small bouquet of fruit and flowers is a simple, abundant setting that elevates eating into the exquisite pleasure of dining. When we take extra moments to prepare an attractive table, you're really performing an invocation, welcoming spirit to be present in recreation and remembrance. Choosing to dine rather than just eat is a small but significant step towards self-nurturance and one to savor as long as we live. Creating an inviting table is possible more nights than you think, especially if you approach it as another venue of artistic expression in your daily round, and confine your efforts, as Perry suggests, to the simple, the doable, and the affordable. Today, start using and enjoying the beautiful things that already surround you in your home. Don't save their loveliness only for other people to recognize and appreciate. Using them, you will become aware that authentic aspirations, from setting a pretty table to finding your life's calling, are legitimate longings. Company is coming for dinner tonight. Guess who? It would be a quantum leap in abundance consciousness if, when your authentic self graces your table, she or he finds generous portions of love, respect, and welcome so richly deserved, served up on the most beautiful plate you own.
We have here but 5 loaves and 2 fishes. Matthew.
Do you know the story of Jesus feeding the crowd of 5,000 believers, seekers, skeptics, and the simply curious who had come to hear him teach? At the end of a long day, when the disciples wanted to send everybody home, Jesus told them not to be ridiculous, that the people were tired and hungry. But we have only 5 loaves of bread and 2 fishes, barely enough for ourselves, the disciples argued. How can we feed that many? Give me what you have, Jesus told them. Then Jesus looked up to heaven, offered thanks, blessed the food, and gave it back to the disciples to distribute. Miraculously, after everyone had finished eating as much as they wanted, 12 baskets of leftovers remained. I love this story because it's such a powerful illustration of abundance consciousness, providing us with the model for simply abundant living. The Gospels of Matthew and Mark report that Jesus performed this simply abundant miracle twice. On the second occasion, 4,000 people were fed with 7 loaves and a few fishes. By this time, the increasingly threatened high priests had started stirring things up. They demanded that Jesus demonstrate more signs and wonders to prove his divinity. He dismissed their taunts and walked away, cautioning the disciples to beware of the yeast of the Pharisees and Sadducees, referring, I imagine, to traditional religious hot air. But the apostles took Jesus' warning literally and assumed that the bread in that town was spoiled. So they decided not to buy any local bread and planned to eat when they got to the next town. Hours later, they found themselves crossing a lake in a boat, with the journey taking much longer than anyone had expected. The disciples began complaining about not having any bread because of the yeast being tainted. Ravenously hungry, they asked, "What will we do? How will we eat?" Jesus, clearly frustrated at their failure to fully grasp his message, berated them with these words, "Oh, you of little faith, why are you talking among yourselves about having no bread? Do you still not understand? Don't you remember the 5 loaves for the 5,000? Or the 7 loaves for the 4,000? And how many basketfuls you gathered? How is it you don't understand that I was not talking to you about bread? Do you have eyes but fail to see? And ears but fail to hear?" This is great stuff, because the delicious morsel hidden beneath the story of abundance and lack is that the apostles just didn't get it. Miracle after miracle kept occurring before their eyes, but they didn't see what was really going on. That's because they were ordinary human beings, even if their spiritual tutorial was being given by a master. It still wasn't enough, because they had not personally experienced an inner shift in reality. The same thing happens with us. How often in our own lives do we still not get it? The "it" could be a power struggle going on in an important relationship, an inability to control our credit card spending, a career problem undermining our self-esteem, the beginnings of an addictive behavior in ourselves or our loved ones, or an unconscious form of self-sabotage that has us bouncing from one self-inflicted crisis to another. The "it" doesn't matter. Some such scenario is occurring in most of our lives and will continue again and again and again until the moment we begin to see the pattern. Perhaps we should start paying attention. It doesn't always have to be deja vu happening all over again. When we don't get it, it's usually because we can't interpret the outward experience as it is relayed over the interior intercom. We can't process it in our souls. What's really happening in our outward lives is somehow taking place in a foreign language that we don't understand. So we either assume that the outward manifestation is reality, which it isn't necessarily, or we keep having to repeat the experience until it starts to make sense, rather like learning a foreign language by total immersion. The poet Edna St. Vincent Millay put it this way: "It's not true that life is one damn thing after another. It's one damn thing over and over." Today, I would love for all of us to get it at last. Not to focus on what we don't have, but to be grateful for what we do. For us to accept, give thanks, bless, and share. For us not to hoard or hold back for fear that there won't be enough. Because spirit lacks for nothing. And as long as you have a few loaves and fishes, and as long as you know what to do with them, all you have is all you need.
She endured and survived. Marginally, perhaps, but it is not required of us that we live well. Anne Cameron.
Oh, yes, it is. We may come back to enjoy another life, and I'm open to that possibility. But until I know for sure, I don't want to waste the one I'm living right now. I've endured and survived, and I've lived marginally. But living well is all it's cracked up to be. And the soul of living well is solitude. Over the years, particularly as I have gradually tried to honor spirits unfolding in my life by not neglecting the gifts within me, I have meditated long and hard about this inner directive, this craving for solitude. For I love the company of my family. I'm excited by brainstorming and creating fabulous projects with a professional team. I adore spending time with close friends. But what I have discovered while composing my authentic concerto is that some of the notes require pauses. I yearn for what May Sarton called open time, with no obligations except toward the inner world and what is going on there. To maintain inner harmony, it is essential for me to ransom at least an hour's worth of solitude out of every 24, and to defend this soul-sustaining respite against all intruders and distractions. Deliberately seeking solitude, quality time spent away from family and friends, may seem selfish. It is not. Solitude is as necessary for our creative spirits to develop and flourish as our sleep and food for our bodies to survive. It is a difficult lesson to learn today to leave one's friends and family and deliberately practice the art of solitude for an hour or a day or a week, the writer Anne Morrow Lindbergh admits. And yet, once it is done, I find there is a quality to being alone that is incredibly precious. Life rushes back into the void, richer, more vivid, fuller than before. I believe that Anne Morrow Lindbergh, who endured more sorrow and success than any of us could even bear to think about, demonstrated with her courageous and creative life that it is not enough for us simply to endure or survive. We must surmount, learn to excel at playing our notes. We must move to a higher octave or a lower one, whichever is necessary to finding the delicate balance between our deepest personal passions and our commitment to family, friends, lovers, and work. And as for me, I have discovered that the surest way to hear the soft strains of harmony is in the silence.
Beauty.
We have plowed and sowed the soulful seeds of gratitude, simplicity, order, and harmony into our lives. Now an authentic harvest of contentment waits to be gathered in, as the fifth simple abundance principle, beauty, beckons us to partake in her bounty. Begin to reap the rich harvest that love has sown. All of us can pull ourselves together some of the time. Some of us can pull ourselves together all of the time. But none of us wants to be pulled together every single moment of our lives. Let's consider those days when you just don't give a damn or are too exhausted to remember to pick up a brush. Can we find inspiration in dirty jeans, an unwashed face, stringy hair? Can there be incarnational revelations when the skirt is too tight and the pantyhose pulls at your hips? I hope so. For I know these days, and these days know me. Probably you were taught, as was I, that how we present ourselves to the world is very important. Unfortunately, our outside packaging counts for far more than it really should. Often when we don't live up to the world's expectations of how we should look or behave, we fall victim to a vicious circle of self-loathing and denial that can be difficult to escape from, unscathed. At times like these, it's a comfort to remember that our souls are more dazzling than cellophane. Beauty is an internal light, a spiritual radiance that all women have, but most women hide, unconsciously, denying its existence. What we do not claim remains invisible, Marianne Williamson observes in A Woman's Worth. But as you become more intimate with your authentic self, as you recover your true, incandescent identity, there will come a gradual but undeniable physical transformation. It is absolutely impossible to commit to your spiritual growth, awaken to your own radiant light, and not have it reveal itself on the outside. It is God's will that we be beautiful, that we love and be loved and prosper in all good things, Marianne Williamson reminds us. It is God's will that we all become the goddesses we were created to be.
Beauty is an ecstasy. It is as simple as hunger. W. Somerset Maugham.
One baby step forward, three giant steps back. I'd been experimenting with the first four simple abundance principles, gratitude, simplicity, order, and harmony, for almost a year and thought I had overcome the buy me syndrome. I enjoyed window shopping and did not feel diminished because I couldn't purchase something that captured my eye. Then I discovered a $45 lifestyle book crammed with pictures of things I love. Lush arrangements of flowers, groupings of silver picture frames, rose chintz. I flipped through visions I wanted to live with. Angrily, I returned it to the bookstore shelf, furious that I couldn't afford the book and fed up that I was not living the lifestyle I thought I wanted. All I had may very well have been all I needed, but that day it certainly wasn't all I wanted. After several hours of churning, I stopped. Something was going on within. This emotional response was occurring for a reason. I meditated on what had pushed my buttons. Was it that I had been living too stringently on a budget? Was I depressed about my lack of money for decorating trifles that I could once have purchased without a thought? Or was something deeper happening? The more I thought about it, the more I realized that I hadn't been paying enough attention to my passion for beauty. My deprivation was caused by not appreciating, savoring, or celebrating the beauty that already existed in my life. So much so that my soul had erupted into a volcano of protest. When something calls to us on a deep enough level to engage our emotions, our conscious attention is sought. Beauty was calling to me, not objects. After I realized this, I headed for the farmer's market for flowers. But instead of one bouquet, I treated myself to three. When I set my lush arrangements of flowers in the living room, my authentic craving for beauty was satisfied very inexpensively, and the wants immediately quieted down. Don't feel you have to deny or ignore your feelings when you want something beautiful but can't afford it. The desire offers clues to satisfy this holy hunger. Explore why you behold something as beautiful. Use your impressions to jumpstart your imagination. Beauty surrounds you. It is everywhere if you search for it, if you're open to having more of it in your life. Here we are, sitting in a shower of gold, the Australian novelist Christina Stead wrote in 1938. With nothing to hold up but a pitchfork.
In this world without quiet corners, there can be no easy escapes. From hullabaloo, from terrible unquiet fuss. Salman Rushdie.
Is there a woman alive who doesn't suffer from stress? If there is, please seek her out. Ask her to share her wisdom. When you find her, I'd be willing to bet she'll offer the following suggestions. Cultivate gratitude. Carve out an hour a day for solitude. Begin and end your day with prayer, meditation, reflection. Keep it simple. Keep your house picked up. Don't overschedule. Strive for realistic deadlines. Never make a promise you can't keep. Allow an extra half hour for everything you do. Create quiet surroundings at home and at work. Go to bed at 9 o'clock twice a week. Always carry something interesting to read. Breathe deeply and often. Move Walk, dance, run. Find a sport you enjoy. Drink pure spring water. Lots of it. Eat only when hungry. If it's not delicious, don't eat it. Be instead of do. Set aside one day a week for rest and renewal. Laugh more often. Luxuriate in your senses. Always opt for comfort. If you don't love it, live without it. Let Mother Nature nurture. Don't answer the telephone during dinner. Stop trying to please everybody. Start pleasing yourself. Stay away from negative people. Don't squander precious natural resources, time, creative energy, and emotion. Nurture friendships. Don't be afraid of your passion. Approach problems as challenges. Honor your aspirations. Set achievable goals. Surrender expectations. Savor beauty. Create boundaries. For every yes, let there be a no. Don't worry. Be happy. Remember, happiness is a living emotion. Exchange security for serenity. Care for your soul. Cherish your dreams. Express love every day. And search for your authentic self until you find her.
To be happy at home is the ultimate result of all ambition. Samuel Johnson.
The wisdom contained in this one sentence is worth meditating on, probably for the rest of our lives. It's also probably the reason Dr. Johnson earned his final resting place with the immortals in Westminster Abbey in London. Why are you working so hard? To be happy at home. But you're never at home in mind, body, or spirit, because you're always working. So why are you working so hard? To be happy at home. This is not a Zen koan. Life is a paradox, but we don't have to make it any harder than it already is. Today, hold this thought. The ultimate result of all ambition is to be happy at home. Engrave this truth on your consciousness. Lay the track deeply, so that even when you're on your own version of automatic pilot, you'll be homeward bound. Write it on the palm of your hand. Sneak a peek at it 3 times a day. Mutter it before agreeing to entertain out-of-town clients on your anniversary, before answering faxes on Sunday, leaving voicemail messages.